you'd go around the ice and collect a few measurements and get as much information as you could from a few measurements. Well, now the paradigm has kind of flipped on its head, where suddenly we have all of these new satellites online collecting terabytes of data, just constantly bringing in more and more data. And so the problem is flipped on its head. And so we're suddenly in the position of having to sift through the data and find, okay, well, what is the coherent story here, and what can we learn about the Earth? And that really requires machine learning. It requires big data analysis and quite a bit of coding just to sort through all of the data that's constantly coming in.
And how much ice has Greenland lost in recent decades?
Well, what we're finding is that in total, about 6,000 gigatons of ice has been lost from Greenland since about the turn of the millennium.
You know, I tried to take those kind of numbers and change them into square miles or acres or something, and I really can't quite picture it. It's just such a huge amount. Is there any way to try and explain to the public what those figures mean?
Yeah. So it is. It's really hard to conceive of how much ice this is. But I think I can give it a shot. So previously, before our study, we already knew that Greenland had lost about 5,000 gigatons over the past few decades to ice thinning. That is, the surface of the ice drawing down. But we hadn't really accounted for retreat at the edges, meaning the ice sheet just shrinking inward. So what our study found is that in addition to the previously known 5,000 gigatons of loss, we now actually are finding an extra 1,000 gigatons due to retreat that hadn't previously been accounted for. And so your question is, what is a gigaton? And so then what is a 1,000 gigatons? That these numbers are kind of abstract. Well, a ton of ice is 1 meter by 1 meter by 1 meter of water weighs 1,000 kilograms, and that's about as much as a car. You can imagine it. You can imagine it just sitting right there on the ground in front of you. Well, if you took those 1 cubic meters and started stacking them in order, just putting them in a row on the ground, and you went all the way around the Earth 25,000 times, that's 1,000 gigatons of ice that we've measured.
Well, no wonder I couldn't picture it. All right. Now, I think a key factor for a lot of people is the rate of ice loss from Greenland speeding up.
Yes, absolutely. So what we found is confirmation of something that had already been observed in other ways, which is that Greenland was losing a little bit of ice, certainly by the end of the 1900s. But then something happened around the year 2000 where global warming really started to take hold, and then we see this really rapid increase in the amount of ice loss that has continued to this day.
Your team made discoveries by tracking the changes in the ice terminus. What is that, and what would it look like if we were there?
If you were there, right at the edges of these glaciers in Greenland, the ice terminus is just the ocean-facing side of the ice. It's right where the glaciers come right up in contact with the ocean. And what we found is that they're crumbling away at the edges, and this means that the location where the terminus is has retreated sometimes miles and miles inland over the past few decades. And what we're finding is that this retreat is present just about anywhere you look in the ice sheet. And this is actually something you can do at home. You can look at old satellite images. Almost anywhere you look in Greenland, if you look at a picture from 1985 versus a picture from today, you'll see that there's not as much ice now as there was just a few decades ago.
It's kind of surprising to hear that more gigatons of ice loss from Greenland would not raise global sea levels. Why not?
Oh, this is a bit of nuance here. So I will say that the specific ice loss that we're reporting, that is the ice lost to retreat, it didn't produce a direct impact on sea level rise. And that's because where the ice was lost, the ocean then was able to come in and filled up the same spot, fill the same volume. So if the ice went away and then was replaced by ocean water, then there's no net change in ocean volume. However, there is an indirect effect that could actually be quite significant. And that is, if you think of Greenland, Greenland is like this big, huge bathtub of ice. If you melted it all down and it all went out into the ocean, then that would raise global sea levels by 25 feet or something like that. The thing about this bathtub of ice is that it all flows out very slowly because it's ice, it's not water. So it flows out through these narrow fjords that connect to the ocean. And these narrow fjords tend to be very deep and narrow, and they're kind of like a bottleneck for this flow of the bathtub of ice trying to make it out to the ocean. Well, what we're finding is that a lot of ice has been lost from inside this bottleneck. So that's like taking the plug out of this drain, and suddenly what we're seeing is that in response, as the glaciers retreat and ice is lost from within these fjords, the glaciers tend to speed up as a result, and that's what causes sea level rise.
So the study finds significant Greenland ice loss that was previously missed, but if the added ice does not raise sea levels, what other things does it impact? Why does it matter?
Right. Well, so there is that indirect effect where when you lose a little bit of ice at the edges of the Greenland ice sheet, it allows glaciers to speed up and then cause sea levels to rise. But then there's this other thing, which is this is a lot of fresh water being dumped into the North Atlantic Ocean. And everything about our global climate system is related to the ocean and how water moves around in the ocean. So the effects are quite huge. If you look very close to Greenland, if you dump a bunch of fresh water, 1,000 gigatons of fresh water, into the ocean right close to the Greenland, what ends up happening is that affects the coastal circulation. And coastal circulation is important because that's what dictates which waters interact with the ice directly. So you can imagine if you redirect warm ocean currents away from the ice, then you'll have less ice melt in the future. But then if you redirect them toward the ice, then you have increased rates of ice melt. What we don't know right now is just how much and what are the exact effects on changing the ocean circulation up close to the coast. Farther away, there is another impact, which is probably going to have much larger impacts on potentially even a global scale. And again, here's a case where we're still sorting out the total impacts, but here's what we do know. We know that on a large scale, dumping 1,000 gigatons of fresh water into the North Atlantic can have large impacts on thermohaline circulation. And the reason that that's important is because Europe's climate and the climate globally is dictated by how ocean heat moves around. Typically, one of the things that drives the AMOC, which is the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, AMOC is driven in part by the process of seawater freezing in the winter. When seawater freezes, you can't have salt water ice, so that salt gets expelled, and then the salt descends down to the bottom of the ocean. Well, as the salty, dense water descends down, that ends up being compensated by pulling surface waters up from lower latitudes. And this sets up a conveyor belt of energy transfer from the south to the north and back again. Well, you can imagine that if you dump a bunch of fresh water onto the North Atlantic Ocean, then in the winter, when it tries to freeze, it doesn't expel much salt. And so if it's not expelling salt, then the water doesn't descend, and suddenly you get a weakening of this major driver of the meridional overturning circulation. So I know that ocean models have predicted that the AMOC is potentially nearing a tipping point, that if you add just a little bit of extra fresh water to the North Atlantic Ocean, then you could significantly weaken or even shut down this AMOX circulation. And that could have large impacts on Europe's climate and beyond.
And you did indeed find just a bit more water than we thought was coming in.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. So we found over 1,000 gigatons of fresh water has been added to the North Atlantic Ocean than previously known. And so what we're still trying to sort out is just how much is this going to affect the ocean circulation that drives these large-scale weather patterns.
Glaciers that end in the sea retreat every summer and then extend, building back again in the winter. What did your study find in those patterns?
Yeah, well, what we found was that there's this natural built-in science experiment in nature. So you're right. Glaciers do have this natural seasonal cycle where they grow throughout the winter and then retreat back over the summer. And if everything were in balance, they would grow the same amount in the winter that they retreat during the summer. What we're finding is that over the past few decades, the summer retreat has far outpaced the growth, so you get this ratcheting back effect. And not only that, is we found this interesting relationship where the glaciers that tend to grow and retreat the most just throughout the seasonal cycles are also the ones that have retreated the most over long-term periods. And that should actually be somewhat intuitive, because what nature is doing from February to August is nature is hitting these glaciers with a large amount of warming. Every summer, it gets warmer than it was in the winter, and we get to see the glaciers respond in real time to the warming that happens over the course of 6 months. What we're finding is that the glaciers that are sensitive to warming over 6 months are also sensitive to the larger scale warming that's been happening over the past few decades. So this tells us that the most sensitive glaciers to seasonal variability are also probably going to be the ones that retreat the most over the coming years as well in response to future warming.
And you found that just three ice streams provide almost a third of the total ice loss in Greenland, and all three terminate in the ocean and not on the land. Is that a factor?
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. So the Greenland is dominated by a few massive ice streams that drain this huge bathtub of ice. And those ice streams are very deep, and they flow straight out to the ocean. And so you have this interface where there's a tremendous amount of energy exchange going on between warm ocean currents, changing atmosphere, and the ice that's just trying to constantly be flowing out to the ocean.
And the study finds that ice streams that advance and retreat with the seasons are a good indicator of climate sensitivity for glaciers. What does this climate sensitivity mean?
Well, climate sensitivity means just how fast is a given glacier going to respond to climate change. And the reason that that's important is because over the next 100 years, if we're trying to plan on sea level rise, we want to know exactly which glaciers are going to respond. And it's the big question is how much and how fast. How much sea level rise are we going to have, and how quickly can it happen? Those questions are directly tied to how the big ice sheets, Greenland and Antarctica, how the glaciers and the big ice sheets are going to respond to changes over the coming decades. So our study shows that the glaciers that are sensitive to seasonal variability are also probably going to be the one that responds to long-term warming. And that so if we're trying to understand where to look for sources of future sea level rise, now we have a roadmap to do that.
And you were able to rule out other factors that people have been looking at for a long time, like surface runoff or the slope of the bed below. How did that work out?
Yeah, yeah. Well, for looking at the geographic distribution of which glaciers are changing the most over long periods of time, certainly surface runoff, meaning the amount of melt that happens at the surface and how that water goes out to the ocean and makes its way to the glacier bed and how that affects that retreat, those things can matter on local scales, but what we found is that the patterns we're seeing were not dictated mostly by surface water runoff, or the strongest predictor we could find of long-term change was, in fact, just the seasonal variability.
Chad, do you think this rule of seasonal variation and climate sensitivity would apply to glaciers in other parts of the world beyond Greenland?
Well, absolutely. Yeah. So what we're seeing is that there's this natural built-in experiment. If you want to understand how glaciers respond to warming, well, we can look at that every single year. The amount of warming that happens from winter to summer is generally far more than the amount of warming we're expecting over the next 100 years. So, yeah, if in science that would be called an impulse experiment. If you want to understand how a system responds to a forcing, you hit it with an impulse and then watch the response. So we can do that every single year now, and we have this massive amount of satellite data that helps us do that.
It sounds like without this new discovery, long-term sea level rise predictions may be off. Is that it?
So we're always refining our projections of sea level rise. There's always uncertainty, and the more we learn, the more we're reducing that amount of uncertainty. So still, there is quite a bit of uncertainty in terms of how much and how fast are the ice sheets going to respond to climate change. There's still some big questions, for example, in West Antarctica about how the Thwaites glaciers and the Thwaites glacier and its neighbors are going to respond to warming over the next 100 years. There's the question of how much additional greenhouse gas humans are going to put into the atmosphere. And then there's the question of how the glaciers are going to respond to that additional forcing.
You're kind of a bipolar scientist, and I mean that in a good way, not a psychological way, but you have experience in both Antarctica and the Arctic, and you published a lot of science about Antarctica. In your view, is there one pole more than the other that is going to affect the world most, and which soonest?
Well, I would say they're both affecting the world quite a bit, even right now. They're totally interesting and different places. So Antarctica is a bit separated, not only in terms of geography and culture, but there's the Southern Ocean that really provides a climatic barrier between Antarctica and the rest of the world. That's why Antarctica is so much colder and will probably take a bit more warming to respond on a large scale and to actually experience the same kind of temperatures that the Northern Hemisphere glaciers experience. But Antarctica is huge, absolutely massive. If it all melted away, it would raise global sea levels by 58 meters. And we're not expecting that sort of melt in our lifetimes or in our grandchildren's lifetimes. But there are some big questions about just how much melt are we going to have from Antarctica and how fast is it going to happen? Because we know that Antarctica is set up for rapid collapse. And interestingly, Antarctica can affect sea levels in North America more than Greenland can. And that's because of a gravitational effect. You can imagine that, well, any two objects with mass tend to pull on each other with a gravitational effect. If you have two glasses of water sitting on a table, they're each pulling on each other just a little bit. And if you add water to either glass, then they'll pull on each other even more. Well, you can imagine that both the Greenland and the Antarctic ice sheets are these massive piles of ice. So the ocean is kind of currently being pulled toward them. And when you lose mass from the Greenland ice sheet, then the ocean around the Greenland ice sheet can relax a little bit, and you can actually see a lowering of sea levels locally close to Greenland. And for that reason, Galveston, Texas, is more sensitive to ice loss from Antarctica than it is from Greenland. These are all very interesting places that affect the world in very different ways, and Yeah, it's just going to be a lifetime of trying to understand them and the nuances and how they're affecting human life.
I think humans have a generalized fear of big changes in the polar world, and maybe that's coded in our battle for survival during past ice ages. As a scientist, has your personal view of concern changed in the last years?
What do you mean, personal view?
Well, are you becoming more worried about what's happening at these poles than you were when you started out?
I try not to bring worry into it. I just have fascination and curiosity. I'm just documenting what I see. And really, I'm just trying to understand the changes and understand what's causing them now and how things are going to change in the future.
And what are you working on now?
Right now, I'm looking at a survey of all of the world's glaciers. So here at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, one of the projects we're working on is analyzing satellite data to understand how glaciers speed up and slow down. And the way we do that is we take a satellite image of a glacier, and any given glacier has crevasse patterns. Crevasses are these big cracks in the ice. And the crevasse patterns are a bit like fingerprints. So you can imagine you take a picture of a glacier and then come back a few weeks or even a year later and take another satellite image. And then you can use essentially with a fingerprint matching algorithm to find how have these patterns of crevasses moved a few pixels over to the left and a few pixels down to the right. And you know how big the pixels are, so now you have a measure of velocity of this glacier. So we've done this for tens of millions of satellite image pairs, and we've now surveyed all of the world's glaciers. So mountain glaciers, there's glaciers on every continent, and Greenland and Antarctica. And what we're doing is just trying to understand how have all of the world's glaciers changed, and what are those impacts on society and on the Earth system.
From the NASA Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, California, we've been speaking with scientist Chad A. Green. You can find links to follow up in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org and check out www.chadagreen.com. Chad, thank you for sharing time with us.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
I have two more bonus questions for Dr. Chad Green, answered by email. First, if only C-terminus glaciers have seasonal variation, and seasonal variation reflects climate sensitivity, where does that leave land-terminus glaciers? Are they less sensitive? Do they lack an indicator? Or are they the same as those that end in the sea? Chad answers, quote, most glaciers in Greenland terminate at the ocean, so our sample set of land-terminating glaciers is pretty small. The changes we do see at land-terminating glaciers tend to be less dramatic than the changes we see at the marine-terminating glaciers, because marine-terminating glaciers are directly acted on by powerful ocean forces. Warm water can melt ice much more efficiently than warm air can, and ocean processes can enhance the effects of atmospheric-driven processes like surface runoff. End quote. Second, currently scientists ask questions of big data, often assisted by machine learning or perhaps AI. And Dr. Chad Green has used this stuff. Do you think AI scanning constantly over data may come up with new questions? Will it identify far-flung relationships like teleconnections we never suspected? Chad replies, quote, we're still at the point where scientists are coming up with the questions, and machine learning or AI are just tools to help answer those questions. That is, AI or ML algorithms aren't coming up with questions to ask themselves and can be extremely effective at finding relationships in data, but the algorithms generally stop short of answering why any particular relationship exists. In other words, AI/ML techniques are generally better at finding correlations than explaining causation. ML/AI may find some apparent far-flung teleconnection, but much like the relationship between lemon imports and U.S. highway fatality rates, understanding the connection between potential drivers of glacier change and the response we see in Greenland requires a great deal of investigation to understand what's a true connection and what's just a coincidence, end quote from Chad Green. Well, sure, the lemons and U.S. highway dust fallacy. I mean, what? That's what I get for asking a NASA scientist questions above my pay grade. It took a deep dive, but it was fun to find this December 2007 paper, The Trouble with QSAR, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Embrace Fallacy. It's by Stephen R. Johnson. I will post that lemon and highway dust graphic in my show blog at ecoshock.org. The point is, both of them seem to follow the same curve, but they're not related. But QSAR? Q-S-A-R? More digging reveals you don't really need to know. QSAR was a predictive theory in chemistry about corresponding structures. Despite a lot of work and publications, it did not work out. Chad basically says AI may find many similar patterns that are coincidences. So far, it takes a trained human to know what is important and perhaps track down the causes. However, I think some important science began with correlations and may develop the mechanism for the causes later. For example, Dr. Jennifer Francis at Rutgers discovered relationships between the amount of sea ice and snow cover in the Arctic and the waviness of the jet stream. In her early work, she did not explain a cause, just posted the observations. Other teleconnections between events, even stretching thousands of miles away, have been discovered. A few papers have established probable chains of events behind those connected changes, but others await more science.
When will AI ask the questions?
Chad is the second scientist I've interviewed to insist humans will ask the questions and then use AI or machine learning to search the relevant data. I'm not so sure. Perhaps within a few years or 10 years, I think artificial intelligence will begin to formulate important and useful questions, and then it will go after the answers. This could happen in biotech, in medicine, space studies, or any human interest, including climate science. Of course, the risk is only another artificial intelligence could verify the work. Is it true? Humans cannot track or document the functioning of artificial intelligence. There are no thoughts or linguistic expressions in that cloud of electronic activity, just math, algorithms, and flows of digital data. We cannot follow. Good luck to us all. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
Honey, it's getting too hot in L.A.
Well, let's call up the Uber and head for Vancouver.
We're Canadians for global warming. All this talk of doom and gloom is really such a bore. We say don't believe those awful warnings. Now someone please shut up that inconvenient Al Gore. There's no need to worry about the glaciers or the penguins. All this talk of politics is really getting old. Besides, we're getting tired of wearing these big parkas. Canadian weather's too wet and cold. So we're Canadians for global warming. America, we know that you really do care. 'Cause we see Pat Robertson on TV every morning saying a prayer for the ozone layer. The Kyoto Accord makes really good handling. What's good for Canada? That's all we care about. Our concern for others is quickly dwindling. We'll build a wall to keep you out. And we love getting a tropical tan at Club Med, Saskatchewan.